This is Douglas Cole, author of The Sales MBA, How to Influence Corporate Buyers, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named as one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. This episode is sponsored by Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. I'll tell you more and how to get a free copy of the book in a few minutes. Now, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Douglas Cole to talk about his book, The Sales MBA, How to Influence Corporate Buyers, published by Barlow Books. Douglas Cole is a sales leader at LinkedIn, an advisor with Startup Accelerators in Canada and the United States, and a part-time university lecturer at the Rotman School of Management and the Schulich Executive Education Center in Toronto. Over more than 20 years in consulting and sales, he has sold tens of millions of dollars in software as a service and advisory work. He holds an MBA from the Wharton School, a master's degree in international studies from the Lauder Institute at the University of Pennsylvania, a master's degree in English literature, and a bachelor's degree in political science and English lit, all from the University of Toronto. And, interesting fact, he is a big fan of the Hello Kitty brand. Douglas, congratulations on the sales MBA, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you so much. That's a spirited introduction. I really appreciate it.
Well, Hello Kitty, I mean, come on. You're confident enough to admit that. Tell us the story about that and why you collect Hello Kitty things.
Yeah, okay. Well, what happened was, this was about maybe, I would say, 15 years ago or something like that. I was in Japan. And I was visiting a friend of mine, and we were both practicing martial arts at the time, and he was plugged into the local community. And one night, we happened to be having dinner with one of the local legends in martial arts, a guy who, you know, was recognizable walking down the street. And we were having dinner with him at this restaurant, and I couldn't help but notice that when he picked up his cell phone to call someone, he had this little Hello Kitty thing dangling off the side of his phone. And it was such a hilarious contrast between, you know, this fearsome, ultra tough exterior and, you know, the sort of silliness and cuteness of this little trinket on his phone. But I remember noticing that it was meaningful in some way. It humanized him. And so I just remember thinking that this brand had something mysteriously compelling about it. And ever since then, I've been collecting bits of Hello Kitty just to remind myself to stay human, always stay human and humble, the way this guy did.
Wow, that's great. And are you still a martial arts enthusiast?
Yes. Yeah. No, I don't practice it anymore because of the injuries, but still interested in the sport. Try to follow it a little bit at least.
Interesting. And your daughters, are they interested in the fact that you're a Hello Kitty enthusiast?
They find it a little bit laughable, to be honest, but but they still indulge it and buy me the odd trinket every so often.
That's great. Well, so I've interviewed a number of authors. It seems to be a growing number who have degrees from Wharton. And I've even interviewed some professors there, including Jonah Berger, who you quote in your book, and Peter Fader, who actually has a new book that I'm hoping to get him back on the show. And also, I noticed you attended Seth Godin's Alt-MBA program. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm not surprised that you have degrees in English, because this book is exceptionally well written. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And I read a lot of these, and they're all good, but this one was even better. There were some phrases you have in here, and I'll quote a few of them, but they were just, it was very, very well done. So I hope it's not your last book. So more importantly, Douglas Cole, I have interviewed another author whose last name is Cole, Jesse Cole. may or may not be related to you. He's the author of Find Your Yellow Tux and Fans First, and he's the owner of the Savannah Bananas baseball team, and he's the guy who only wears yellow tuxedos in public.
They see me rolling, they hating.
And I should add, Douglas Cole, that I went to Cole High School in San Antonio, Texas, and there's another guy that went to Cole High School, this Irish kid named Shaquille O'Neal, who went on to become, an NBA great. And, you know, I taught him everything he knows about basketball. And yet to this day, he claims, you know, he doesn't know who I am. But that's, you know, Shaq, we both know the truth here. But, you know, that's okay. That's okay. I like to pay it forward. So I've interviewed an author named Cole. I went to Cole High School, and I've interviewed over 300 authors. But Douglas Cole, I have never interviewed an author named Douglas. So I realize this interview is just getting started, but you may be my favorite author I've ever interviewed.
it's all very meta, isn't it?
Yes, yes. I'm excited. And I'll be using your name a lot, not just because it's an effective sales tactic, but, you know, rather than getting started talking about your book, let's spend the first 45 minutes or so talking about just how awesome it is to be named Douglas, because I rarely get to talk to somebody about this kind of thing. So no, I'm not going to do that. I have too much affection and respect for my audience. I don't want to make them suffer more than they already do, which is why I try to get the author to do most of the talking. But seriously though, every episode, there's a first-time listener, Marketing Book Podcast. And this may be their first episode they've ever listened to, and I'm glad you're here. But they may be thinking, why is a book about sales on the Marketing Book Podcast? Good question. And the reason why, as I step up on my soapbox here, is that the best marketers have a deep understanding of sales, what the salespeople are doing, the sales process, and more importantly, the buyers. The more they understand their buyers, the better. And also, it changes their perception amongst people who don't really understand what marketers do, or they misunderstand it. If you can speak the language of sales, not to mention accounting, it really can help you tremendously. And that's why I argue that every marketer should read at least one sales book a year. And if it's good, share it with your sales team. So now you work for LinkedIn. I'm not a lawyer and I don't play one on TV, but I wanted to say this is not a LinkedIn product. You work for them, but this is your work with their blessing. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, this is an official side project. It's not done under the aegis of LinkedIn. It's just a personal project for sure.
Okay, great. So I know, because I know the LinkedIn legal department's probably listening to this to make sure you're behaving. So I want to get that out there. And let me quote from a couple sections in the beginning of the book, and then talk about some of the key ideas here. So on page XII, that's 13 for the folks in Rome. I suspect there's a traffic cop standing at the crosswalk of your attention and that you're waiting for a signal on whether to pause, proceed, or pivot in a new direction. You're waiting, in other words, for an answer to the obvious question. Is this book for me? That's the question any honest and respectful author must directly address. The Sales MBA is written for you. If you want to get better at influencing corporate buyers, you could be a sales professional who works with enterprise clients. You could be a startup founder who sells business-to-business products or services, or you could be a direct influencer who allocates money and people within your company. If you're an enterprise sales professional, I consider you to be the primary audience. However, if you find that selling your idea to corporate stakeholders is an increasingly vital part of what you do, as is the case for many people in today's economy, then this book will also help. And then I want to go on to page 16 of the intro, where you write, despite or perhaps because of the lack of formal sales programs in post-secondary education, the market for sales training is immense. This explains the apparently endless supply of how-to materials on offer. Thousands of books, consultants, and online instructors claim they can, in fact, teach you how to sell. I've gone through many of these materials and they've taught me a lot. But I've also noticed they lack something, especially when it comes to the challenge of engaging corporate buyers. So Douglas Cole, what is it that they're missing?
Well, in essence, what I explain in the introduction is that there are three different ways of teaching somebody a better way to do one's work. And you can talk about skill set, you can talk about tool set, and you can talk about mindset. And what I've observed with the vast majority of not only sales books, but most how-to books in general will focus on the skill set and the tool set. Mm-hmm. They'll talk about a particular methodology. They'll talk about perhaps some apps or technologies that might be helpful. That's the typical approach. And it is not useless by any means. I think if you're trying to educate someone and get someone to go from zero to 90, then those are the approaches that are probably the most pragmatic in terms of achieving that outcome. The thing that I notice as missing is that there is this mindset element, which is much harder to teach. It's a little bit more elusive, but it is such a central component of top performers. When you look at someone who graduates from a 90% performance, you know, to the top of the heap in professional life and in athletic life or whatever their domain, what you will always notice is that the people who are the very best, they have a distinctive mindset. There's a certain mentality that they bring to every practice, to every game. And that's what allows them, that's what gives them staying power. That's what gives them drive. That's what gives them focus in each of those engagements. And so what I've tried to do in the case of sales is think about what are the components of that mindset and how do I tease out the sub-elements in a simple framework. And so that's what the book tries to do. It tries to teach this mindset element, and it tries to lay out, you know, almost like a standard curriculum that one can think of for especially enterprise sales. For some reason, that general curriculum seems to be lacking.
Right. And so can you talk briefly about the evolution of the salesperson in terms of how a lot of them start out? There's three steps, and ultimately where they are, I guess, which would be that last 90 to 100%
yeah,
part.
Right. Well, I think there is a predictable progression that I've seen time and time again in the sales profession. And generally what happens is that when somebody begins in sales, there's a conflict. There's an inner emotional conflict. The newcomer in sales is acutely conscious of the fact that he or she is trying to get a very busy stranger to pay attention and to buy something, which he or she may not actually need. And so the newcomer in sales is very discomfited by this and tries to cover up that feeling by trying to be as likable and as charming as possible. That's the likability phase, which I think is the common mindset for the beginner in sales. And then as that person gets better at the craft, he or she starts to think about win-win outcomes, mutually beneficial outcomes. You know, what's good for me? What's good for the client? How do I engineer an outcome that satisfies the two of us?
And which is better than the first.
Which is better than the first. And that's what I'm calling, you know, mutuality as phase two. And the highest phase, the one that's definitely a more rarefied space to be, is what I'm calling objectivity. You know, just think of it as this plausible objectivity where even though the salesperson clearly has a quota, clearly they have a self-interested reason for getting to a sale, nonetheless, that seller is perceived by the client as someone with a legitimate objectivity and perspective on the client's situation and is therefore seen as a trusted advisor. And so I'm using this book to examine what are the foundations of such objectivity? What are the things that you need to be good at in order to be able to be seen as plausibly objective in a buying situation?
Right. And so the book has four sections, but it's primarily organized into these three areas, which is becoming a strategist, becoming a change agent, and becoming a decision architect. And I want to kind of go in that order if we could talk about a couple things from there. But talk to us about what led you to focus on those three areas. That's always fascinating to me that an author could have 97 areas, but instead you picked those three.
Well, I think that it is, first of all, just a natural inclination as a function of having come from consulting and being involved with teaching. I'm always looking for the rule of three. You know, that's a commonly known teaching construct that's most useful. Our brains tend to process conceptual triplets, you know, better than quintuplets and sextuplets or whatever. Right. So I was thinking, you know, what is the three-part framework that is most salient here? And but also it just seemed to fit naturally with what really do appear to me to be the first principles of any kind of enterprise sales conversation, there's an external component to it. In other words, there are these external market dynamics that impact the discussion. There's an organizational component to it in the sense of all the things that are happening within the client's company. And then there's an interpersonal component in the sense of what is unique about this person's point of view in psychology, and how do I understand that, and how do I relate to it? So it just struck me that those three dimensions, external, organizational, and interpersonal, were the primary overlapping filters that were relevant to any sales conversation. And then I'm thinking that if I were to characterize in simple language, someone who has mastered each of these realms, what is the label that you might give to that person? And so that's the reason I'm saying that it's, you become a strategist by understanding the external variables, you become a change agent by mastering the organizational variables, and you become a decision architect by mastering these interpersonal variables. So that's the thinking behind it.
Yes. Well, let's jump into some of these. I want to quote from the introduction, page 21, where you write, "This book is framed as a sales MBA because, like a business school program, it's meant to build a common understanding of frameworks and approaches that help to address company challenges. But I'm also suggesting there's a mismatch between a traditional MBA curriculum and the practice of sales. Selling skills are not substantially improved with a better understanding of accounting, finance, or marketing. As someone who holds an MBA and has transitioned from consulting to sales, I can firmly attest to this. However, business acumen is indeed a powerful lever in sales, and it remains a growth area for many sales professionals." What do you mean by business acumen? Because that's a term that almost everyone probably has an idea of what it means, but explain what you mean by it.
Basically, how businesses make money. How they earn the willingness of a customer to pay for what it is they have to offer. Mm-hmm. In simple terms, that's what a business has to solve for. In slightly more elevated terms, it's understanding what this company needs to do in order to win and prevail in the marketplace. And so I think for that this is largely about the strategy section. I think for that you need to understand the essential components of strategy. What does the term strategy actually mean? What does a business strategy actually amount to? And how can I use those concepts to come across as someone who's a more credible advisor to my client? That's basically what I'm talking about with business acumen.
Yes, and let me add to that. You write on page 2, "Strategy has become a nebulous term. In hundreds of coaching conversations with salespeople, I've often posed the following question. What's the strategy of your most important client? The question usually triggers a confused expression or a halting attempt to stitch together a patchwork of observations. Rarely has anyone answered it crisply and with confidence." So you have several pages on strategy. Explain what strategy is or what it's not. And let's talk about the two questions that every salesperson should be able to answer about their prospect's business strategy.
Sure. Yeah. Well, strategy is one of these frustrating,
like business acumen.
Yeah. It's like one of these shibboleths of the business life. And so it's a very, very flexible term. People sort of read into it what they want. But in essence, what I'm saying is that something is not really a strategy unless it incorporates some understanding of choices, trade-offs, and unique advantage. I mean, those define, in essence, what a true business strategy is, because any business could have sort of a general intent with respect to what it wants to do in the market. Anything ranging from a vision or mission to, let's say, a financial objective, right? But that's not really strategy. A strategy is when you're very consciously deciding where to compete, where not to compete, mm-hmm. and what is the basis of that decision. And that's what I mean by competitive advantage. So those are the essential components, the sort of yolk and albumen of the term strategy. And what I'm saying is that strategy is a very deep concept. There's a lot written on it, and I don't want to overly complicate. I just want to give the reader the minimum effective dose to be more effective as a strategist. And so what I'm trying to do here, as in other sections of the book, is reduce the complexity of this topic down to a couple of pointed questions, which can guide them in the right direction. And for the sake of becoming a strategist, I'm saying that the two most important questions are, where do they compete, and how do they win, or how can I help them win? So the reason why I'm narrowing strategy down to those two questions is that they require you to come to an understanding of choices and trade-offs and unique advantage. You need to understand, in order to know where a company is competing, you do need to have some sense of who their target customer is, whether it's an individual buyer or a particular segment. Where are they competing? And where have they chosen not to compete by implication? And then what is the rationale for that? What is the unique advantage they're bringing to that particular segment, such that they believe they can prevail and hopefully win against the competitors in that space? So those two questions, I think, force you to really narrow down your understanding of what a company's strategy is, and to become, you know, more credible as someone who can have a strategic conversation with a client.
Brilliant. Where do they compete and how will they win? So when you've asked that to a salesperson and they have the answers to those two, I suppose you're pleased.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what I'm looking for with the question.
Right. Yeah, but let's talk about the target customer. Another, I just want to quote one more time from the book. You write, in answering the first of the two strategy questions, where do they compete? The easiest place to start is with the target customer. After all, the fundamental purpose of a business is, as management theorist Peter Drucker once said, to create a customer. Your client's target customer is the keystone variable. It defines the competitive parameters of their business, and it has enormous influence on their allocation of company resources. Your most basic responsibility, then, is to figure out who buys from your customer and why. Is that more rare in your experience, that salespeople have that understanding?
Yeah, it is rare because it requires work. You know, it requires extra effort. Typically, you know, I say this somewhere in the book that, you know, typically when people think about sales, you know, one of the most common pieces of advice is that you have to empathize with your client, and that's certainly true. By no means would I dispute it. What I'm saying in the case of the strategy discussion is that it requires you to go one step further, not just to empathize with your client, but to empathize with the customer of your client. And that's essentially what I think you need to do in order to understand strategy. It's a bottom-up way of answering the question of where do they compete and how do they win? Because when you look at the world through the eyes of your client's target buyer, then you are forced to answer these questions. How does that buyer see your client? What is the particular, how does that person frame the product or service? What does that person compare the product or service to? Does it compare favorably or unfavorably? And in what respect? You know, and so on and so forth. And so it's a way of just, again, I'm trying in many of these instances to just to make the concept, a very complex notion of strategy, more workable and pragmatic for the sales profession. And I think if you just go through that exercise of trying to put yourself in the shoes of the buyer, then it allows you to break down something as complex as a strategy.
Yes. And one of my favorite lines from the book is where you write, strategy is built around a clear understanding of the customer.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Sorry, it just got me really excited. TV advertising is a powerful channel for business growth, and it's a counterintuitive solution for businesses frustrated by the rising costs of digital marketing. But the traditional process for launching TV campaigns is expensive, time-consuming, and complex. That's why marketing architects flipped the traditional process on its head. With all-inclusive TV advertising, they invest their own money to produce, analyze, and optimize your TV campaign. All you pay for is media, setting you up for rapid growth at a significant cost advantage. This approach to TV is so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. It's called All-Inclusive TV, How Booming Brands Are Reimagining TV Advertising. It explores how a variety of brands are using TV to transform their businesses and how you can do the same. For a free copy of the book, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book and tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast. In chapter three, you talk about value proposition, which is probably a helpful reminder for folks of what it actually is. You write that to understand your client's value proposition is the most rigorous way to delineate where they compete and how they can win. Back to those two questions. Can you remind listeners what a value proposition is and then maybe talk a little bit about the framework that you outline in the book? There's only six parts to it. But talk about what a value proposition is, because like strategy or business acumen, it's probably not always fully understood.
Sure. Yeah. No, I think basically you are trying to tease out the components of a reason for buying and why the buyer, you know, chooses to purchase from your client for a product or a service. And the launch pad for that particular discussion is some of the work that I've done with startups. And the reason for that is that a startup has this do or die urgency to really, really go deep on this question of who is my target buyer. Mm-hmm. And without knowing that, it's really, really hard for a startup to gain traction and to build momentum in the market. And so it's something that also has application to larger corporations. I mean, companies, as they grow and become more mature, they still need to be rooted ultimately in who their target buyer is. And so I go through this framework, which is an iteration on a framework from Jeffrey Moore, who wrote Crossing the Chasm, which is mm-hmm. kind of a Bible of the startup space.
Yeah.
And I just walk through, you know, what are the components of a value proposition? You need to understand what the problem you're solving is. You need to understand what your solution to that problem is. You need to understand how that solution is framed. What's the category that's used? You need to understand what it's compared to. You need to understand some of the additional integrated secondary benefits of your product or solution. So I just go through each of these components, and I'm basically suggesting that, I know, again, this is, it feels like extra work. It feels like an absurd demand on a salesperson to sort of think about this from the perspective of the end buyer. But I think that if you can answer these questions, if you do have a sense of how you would flesh out that customer value proposition, then you are in a position to advise a company and to say, well, my sense when I think about the headspace of someone who's considering your service or product, my sense is that we can be helpful with respect to your relative positioning in A, B, and C reasons, whatever. It actually becomes a very practical and powerful way to get attention and to ultimately get agreement.
Absolutely. And let me just mention what these six are, because if you're a marketer, you're a sales manager, you're a CEO, you're a salesperson, and you haven't worked through this, get started. Number one is the problem. What does your client solve? Mm-hmm. Two, customer. Who is your client's primary buyer? Three, positioning. How will that buyer frame your client's product or service, how that buyer frames it? Four is alternatives. To what other product service will the target buyer compare your client's offering? Mm-hmm. Five is differentiation. What are your client's competitive advantages and disadvantages? And six, integrations. What are the indirect benefits for the target buyer of using your client's product or service? So you also have an entire chapter on how to determine how your prospective customers or existing customers measure success. Can you explain why that is so important and how to go about finding out what the real measures of success are within an organization, regardless of what they may be saying?
Yeah, well, in the strategy section, I'm looking for different frameworks and different angles you can bring to your analysis or research on an account in order to tease out an answer to these questions of where do they compete and how do they win. And so in addition to the customer value proposition, I bring up this concept of OKRs, or objectives and key results, which mm-hmm. is sort of a Google-based framework for thinking about what is the overarching goal of the organization, and then what are the underlying metrics that will get them to that goal. And And what I'm suggesting is that here, the reason why you should make this your mission to try to tease these out is that they too are an example of a company making choices. Once you find out what the overarching objectives and key results are for the business, that gives you an indication of the kinds of decisions that they've made with respect to where to compete and how to win. And so in the book, I use an example of a corporation which was kind of hard to research because they were part of a triopoly. You know, there were three main contenders in this space. They were just one of three telecom giants. You know, there wasn't a meaningful difference between what they did and what one of their competitors did.
Fairly mature.
Yeah, that's right. Very mature
industry.
Not a charismatic founder, you know, articulating some sort of colorful vision for the future, but nothing like that. It was just very, very staid. And and so what was helpful in that case was to try to figure out what are the one or two metrics that are getting a lot of attention, disproportionate attention from the senior ranks. And through talking with the teams, we realized that proposal volume was really, really important to them. And the reason why it was really important was that because they were working within an industry structure that only had three companies, roughly speaking, that they basically had something like a 50% chance of winning for any proposal that they submitted to a potential customer. And so that industry structure drove a very specific metric, which, you know, if we could influence, we realized that we could get the executive team's attention. And so that became the real focus of our team's work is to try to think, well, how can we increase proposal volume? Because, you know, a 1 point increase has, you know, a 50% payoff potentially, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason for focusing on these metrics or objectives and key results as a way to tease out the strategy.
Yes. And you have to do a little bit of digging to find out that they might not have told you that initially, but you had to get in there and figure out what really mattered to them.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So there could be a lot of smoke screens a salesperson could be hearing about what's important, but you got to go a little further, it seemed to me.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, a salesperson is not unlike an investigative journalist a lot of the time.
Yes.
You really have to keep asking the five whys, and you have to keep trying to go beyond what people tell you and try to triangulate what someone tells you with what someone else says. You know, you can never just take one input as gospel.
Yeah. Oh, that's what they said. No. Yeah. Watch their feet. So let's go to the second section about becoming a change agent. And so a while back, episode 269 was with Jonah Berger, author of The Catalyst, and which you mentioned in the book. And he makes the point that in that book that changing humans is more like chemistry than physics.
Right.
Walk us through that concept of becoming a change agent having to do with not forcing change, but removing barriers and allowing change to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I do. I did enjoy his book, The Catalyst, and it definitely was an important influence on this section. The essence of it is that human beings are most distinct from inanimate objects in the sense that when you try to push a human, you run up against something called reactance.
Yes,
you get a natural pushback.
Yeah,
and so his core thesis
said the guy with two teenage daughters. No, I'm kidding. I have kids too, so yeah, I know. I'm not going to tell you what's ahead, but yeah,
that's right. Yeah, so instead of focusing on confrontation that way, one needs to focus on removing the friction, and change is very much about trying to find the pre-existing energy sources and introducing a catalyst in order to bring about, you know, a catalytic reaction, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the reason for the chemistry analogy. And in just simple terms, you know, to go again back to the two questions, you know, just as when we were talking about strategy, we reduced it to those two questions in the last section. In this section, I'm saying that the two most important questions are, where is the energy for change in this organization and how can I feed that energy?
Right.
That goes back to this this notion of just wanting to remove barriers and the sources of friction. And
right, you talk about a surfer and their relationship with a wave.
harnessing the pre-existing energy. Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of, I still have a lot of conversations with salespeople who sort of talk about the fact that the customer thinks this one way and they need to change that way of thinking, that which to me, again, sounds more like physics. And I think the question you always, if possible, it's not always possible, but usually there is some initiative that's getting a lot of attention. It's getting hammered home in every single frontline manager meeting and at every company all hands meeting, et cetera. And those are the issues you want to tease out. Those are the issues that you want to attach yourself to in terms of finding that pre-existing energy source. And so that's basically what I'm talking about in this section.
Right. And I've also got to say that there's a section on, I think it's that same chapter, page 53, where from your Alt MBA program with Seth Godin, right, where you wrote two or three pages about what the perspective is of a customer as it relates to change. We can't go through all that, but can you explain what that is? Because that part was a real eye-opener.
Yeah, well, it was for me too, which is why I was determined to put it into the text. And the reason was that in that course, we were challenged by our instructor. We were challenged to not just to think about objection handling. This is the typical angle. If you're going through a sales course or something, they'll say, okay, what might they say in order to object to us? And then how do we overcome that? So it wasn't about that. It was this radical empathy where they were saying, okay, if you were to put yourself in the customer's shoes and not just imagine their perspective, but imagine that it's the right perspective. Imagine that it's actually the heroic perspective on the situation and that you are on the low ground, not the high ground. And what would it sound like in that case? And it was a really interesting imaginative exercise to go through. And so that's the reason why I felt compelled to include it, because when I sort of walked through that logic of the customer as hero, I started to see all the different ways in which I or my sales team, might quite legitimately be perceived as just basically tone deaf to the customer's reality.
Right. Like saying, throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Right.
Which a lot of salespeople are probably unconsciously saying, and what the prospect is thinking they're asking them to do, rip it out and put in a new whatever it is.
Yep, exactly.
So chapter 7 is titled, Why Do We Change? Well, we don't want to, but can you talk to us about the role that personal interests and social influences and structural surroundings play in making change happen? Because change does happen, but it's not always for the reasons we think it is.
Yeah. Well, I did a lot of exploration and trying to find different articles on change. Of course, as you can imagine, there's a ton that has been written on the topic. And the best framework that I can find, the best construct for thinking about change is one that goes back to this metaphor, which I think it was initially came from Jonathan Haidt in his happiness hypothesis. And he talks about this image of the rider and the elephant as a way of illustrating three things that are necessary for any kind of significant change, whether you're talking about people or organizations. And he said that there is a personal, a social, and a structural component to the process of change. And the rider and the elephant illustrate these three points, because the person on top of the elephant is a symbol of the personal reasons. That individual has to give very, very precise and prescriptive directions to the elephant to get it to move in a certain direction. The elephant symbolizes the immensity of the social influences, or these non-rational influences that could easily overwhelm, the personal rational direction that the rider is providing, but have to be harnessed in some way. And then the path represents the structural environment, the surroundings that determine the direction in which the elephant can move, right? So you have the rider, the elephant, and the path. These are symbolic of the personal, the social, and the structural. And so what I talk about in the book is how if you want to get rigorous about change, if you want to think about, a simple framework to almost function as sort of a checklist to work through systematically, I'm arguing that these are the most critical components. If you think about the reason why someone stops smoking, or the reason why an organization does a very sudden about face, you can always tied back to these three things, I would say.
you're a martial arts guy. Is there one particular form of martial arts that tries to take advantage of the energy of the opponent, or is that all of them? Is that like judo or jiu-jitsu?
Yeah, so many of them do that.
Yeah. That came to mind when I was reading. And I just wanted to quote from chapter 8. This was great. Just to reinforce that you don't want to you want to catch the wave. You write, mm-hmm. The primary responsibility of a change agent is to understand and articulate the dominant motivation of the people you're hoping to change. Typically, these people are the end users of your product or service. You should be looking to harness the energy behind their pre-existing commitments in much the same way a surfer uses the energy of a wave. In redirecting that energy, you essentially have two options. One, you can offer a new insight that prompts people to behave differently, or two, you can provide new information to support a decision they have already made. By far, the most efficient path is the second. And it was another well-written line where you say the mindset of a change agent is to seek out and select the birds that influence the overall flight pattern. Mm-hmm. Man, how is selling to large organizations analogous to guerrilla warfare?
Well, I think that it is analogous in the sense that the seller or the sales team is a little bit like a band of guerrilla combatants, in the sense that they want to make themselves felt omnipresent, even though numerically they are just sort of a trivial force. And that is something that requires, I think, a good understanding of these three dimensions, because you need to find leverage somehow as a seller, as a selling team. And so I talk about how I talk about some practical examples, in fact, of people who have done this very well. You know, there was one of my former colleagues who sold an extremely large program to a very large company. She took it from having a very small ring fence program to one that was enterprise wide. And she did it by embracing this sort of guerrilla mentality, because she found that there was this one overarching theme that was getting talked about in all sorts of meetings across the company. So that shows, in other words, she found that personal interest. She mm-hmm. found a way to tie what she was trying to do with her program to that specific priority. She then, you know, you go back to that bird analogy of finding the birds who are influencing the overall flight pattern. She found some very influential people within the organization who were sort of known as innovators and highly respected innovators. And she was able to get time with them and position this program as a way for them to reinforce that brand. So she gave them a personal reason for wanting to get behind this, but she also in getting them on board, she got tremendous leverage because they were highly influential. And then third, she, in terms of the structural component, she thought about, well, where is it that people are just spending most of their time, you know, digitally and physically, you know, which system gets visited the most, whether it's a CRM or a training environment? What are the meetings that people attend on a regular basis? You know, what are the meetings that have the most impact on what they choose to do? And she found a way to build, you know, some kind of surrogate presence within these different environments, digital and physical. And it was the combination of those three things, you know, tapping into personal interests, engaging social influencers, and then embedding herself in the structural environment. That was why she managed to be so successful here. That was how she managed to convert a very small program into a very large program.
Yes. And when we say social influences, I think we should make it clear, we're not talking about social media influencers. It's more like what is influencing folks internally.
Yeah. Good correction. Exactly. Yep.
Let's go to the third section on becoming a decision architect. And let's talk about Douglas Cole. Tell us the story of your European vacation where you ordered at a smoothie shop the Dieter's Special and what that has to do with decision architecture.
Well, yes, I remember it well. I had come back from a vacation in Greece and I was all, you know, sun-kissed and relaxed, but also feeling a little bit unhealthy because, you know, been eating and doing very little active for quite some time. And so I came back and we were in Athens. We were having breakfast as a family at this cafe. and I had this smoothie menu, and it looked very enticing. I had all these really fancy smoothie concoctions, and they had these ridiculous titles, you know, like a dieter special and a lover's concoction, and all these different absurd promises.
Yeah, I mean, who would fall for that, right?
Yeah. And I just remember,
an anti-aging elixir.
I just remember laughing with my family, saying, "I mean, this is just ridiculous. I mean, look how overpriced these stupid things are. Does anyone actually think that these do what they're supposed to do? I mean, it's just a complete marketing hoax." And anyway, so we chuckled about it, and then the waiter came over to the table, and I just never forget this moment where, as I made my order, I couldn't stop myself from ordering the dieter special, because I just wanted to feel slightly more healthy after 2 weeks of sloth. Right. And I just remember, and I always think back on that moment, because I realized that you can be as rational as you want. You can look at all these things, like the ridiculous promises that are made on a smoothie menu. But when it comes down to the brass tacks in human decision-making, we will very often default to these overpowering irrational impulses because we want to feel a certain way. It all sort of ties into our self-concept. And so I use that story to introduce the decision architect section, because I just want to remind people, and I'm not the first person to say this, but I do try to elaborate on it in a fairly rigorous way, is that we don't make decisions based on rational criteria. We're not rational. We rationalize a pre-existing emotional state. And so the purpose of that decision architect section is to elaborate on that and provide some practical tactics and principles that people can use.
So decision architecture, back to the vocabulary words, what is decision architecture?
Well, essentially designing the variables that impact the way people decide. And because, as I said, these decisions are very often the natural consequence of just of these variables, rather than through the rational intent of the person who's making the decision. And so what I do in this section is it's also a term that comes from behavioral economics, which is sort of the overarching intellectual influence of this section. It struck me that when I was reading behavioral economics literature, they have a framework. The whole field of behavioral economics is based on this three-part framework, which is human decisions are constrained, they're limited by these bounds of attention, bounds of rationality, and bounds of self-interest. And it occurred to me that that's exactly the case with selling as well. Ultimately, if you think about what someone has to do for a sale, the first thing you have to do is get a buyer's attention. So you're working within bounds of attention. Mm-hmm. The second thing you need to do is you need to get a buyer to make a certain judgment about the information you're providing.
Well, and that's the bounds of rationality, which aren't necessarily that rational.
Exactly. Yeah. So you're working within these bands of rationality. And then the third thing is you want them to do something. You want them to take action in some way. And in order to achieve that, you need to be working within bounds of self-interest. So that same three-part construct from behavioral economics, I find to be immediately relevant to sales. And so that provides the basis for the discussion in that section.
Yes. And it seems like that those are a real blind spot, because people think that they're paying attention to your marketing or sales. You think that they're going to make a rational decision, and they're going to do what's best for the company, when actually their self-interest is the big driver. It's interesting, and it seems like it's things we forget about. And there was a line, it just seemed like values and priorities are more important than facts or reasoning. It was a great reminder there. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about, now, I know this is more about mindset, but let's talk about some ninja mind tricks here. Let's talk about how to speak to the subconscious, which is a great title of a chapter. And just remind folks about some of the ways that we can do that. And also Robert Cialdini's book, Influence, Psychology of Persuasion, is a really, really popular book with a lot of the listeners. So I loved how you walked through his now seven principles, showing over like a 24-hour period, I think it was.
Yeah, well, Cialdini's book, which I agree is canonical for anyone in sales or marketing, Cialdini, the Influence, the Science of Persuasion, he's basically a harbinger of behavioral economics. His argument is very much analogous to the arguments of the behavioral economics community, in the sense that he says that when we're processing information, The world is too complex, and so therefore we look for these cues. We look for these shorthand cues that allow us to come to make judgments about things very quickly. They're efficient ways of processing our complex reality. And so Cialdini talks about these seven things: scarcity, reciprocity, social proof, commitment, likability, authority, and unity. And he says that, in so many instances, we're just looking for a way to quickly come to an assessment of the situation. So you decide you want to buy whatever it is, shaving oil on Amazon. And so you will immediately look to see what the reviews are, because that social proof is just the quickest way to know whether something is worth paying attention to, right? Mm-hmm. You made an offhand reference at the start of our interview. You talked about, the fact that we have the same first name.
Yeah.
Douglas. There's something about that. It's totally non-rational, but there is something about that which makes me like you instantly more than if you didn't have the same first name as me. That's, this concept of unity and likability.
Likewise.
So there's, and of course, as we proceeded to talk, I now have legitimate reasons to like you beyond that. But, right off the bat, it started off well.
I like where this is going, Douglas.
So anyway, the point is that, when you're talking about, in particular, the first of those three points, which is working within bounds of attention, you need to be really conscious of these influence levers and how they affect the subconscious. If you're designing, for example, an outreach email, or if you are designing a proposal, I think it's always good to remind yourself of these. I always advise some sellers I work with that you should have a checklist where these things are just right there in front of you. Such that every time you're sending out a communication, a very important communication to, let's say, an influential stakeholder, you just want to make sure that you've thought about how to layer in some of these elements, because they are reinforcing. You find that communications and ad campaigns and persuasion campaigns are more effective to the degree that they incorporate a number of these different influence levers. And so that's what I talk about.
No book has been mentioned more in the books that have been on this show than Robert Cialdini's book, Influence: The Psychology of Persuasion. And if you are in marketing or sales, you should read that book, and it'll be a book that'll stick with you. It's one of the very first books that you should read. And actually, he updated it last year. It's like double the size, and there were always six. And he added this seventh one, which was unity. And that's where in the book he talks about how he likes certain musicians, like, was it Justin Timberlake or something? And the reason why is because they, like he, are Green Bay Packers fans.
Interesting.
So it's like you talked about you were born in Cape Town and you noticed, a rugby shirt? Or you were wearing a rugby shirt and somebody made this connection with you.
Yeah, that's right. I remember I was disrupted one day before dinner by a knock at the door, and I went to go and open the door, and the guy who was trying to do some sort of door-to-door sales job on me, he noticed that I was wearing a South African rugby shirt, and he mentioned that his mother was from South Africa, and it just, it instantly, I reluctantly acknowledged that he was pretty damn good at his job, because while I wanted to get back to the dinner table, I couldn't deny that there was a certain sense of unity I felt with him with that observation. So yeah, these things are powerful. We can talk about how immune we are to them, but they speak to deep aspects of our identity.
They worked on Douglas Cole, author of the Sales MBA.
That's right.
Now, he wasn't selling diet or smoothies, was he?
No. He was he was looking for charity donations. Yeah.
Okay. So, well, great. Just a quick reminder. Another one that's a concept that is so powerful, and it's actually been mentioned in two other books that have been on recently, Evolutionary Ideas by Sam Tatum and From Impressed to Obsessed by John Picot, which is the peak end rule. Mm-hmm. And talk about how that is probably even more powerful for the B2B sales process, particularly long drawn out sales processes.
Yeah. The reason I talk about that is that when you think about an enterprise sales cycle in particular, which tends to be a longer sales cycle, what you're talking about is essentially a series of conversations. And when you are watching a sales cycle that's going well, or when you're part of one that's going well, what you're doing essentially is that you're building momentum over the course of those conversations. And so it what it means in practical terms is that when you are preparing for an engagement with the client, you know, for every meeting, you want to be thinking about how you are contributing to that ongoing momentum. You want to be thinking about how you can maximize the memorability of that encounter and positive memorability of that encounter so that you can continue to build emotional, the emotional force of your sale, so to speak. So the peak end rule is basically saying that, you know, our memories are a kind of simplification of what's happened in the past. You know, again, it's this recurring theme throughout the book and throughout behavioral economics. Reality is too complex, and we're right. always looking for ways. Our brains are always looking for ways to compress it, you know,
yes.
to efficiently compress it, and that works with memories as well. And what the peak end rule says is that we remember an experience because of the peak emotion of that experience, and because of the way the experience ended. Those are the two most important dimensions of any experience. And so, when you're a sales professional and you're designing a meeting, it's actually quite important to think about, well, how does my agenda maximize the memorability of this meeting? How do I ensure that there is some kind of emotional peak? And how do I then ensure that it ends in a way that is most positive, right? And so in the book, I remember there was a great meeting I was part of where I was watching a colleague of mine do this extraordinarily well. And he sort of set the team up. There was a bunch of executives, and he asked them right off the bat, you know, what was something that wasn't on their LinkedIn profiles. And they talked about, you know, personal interest in a way that allowed them to loosen up and develop more of a human connection. And so, you know,
remembered that.
Yeah. He opened them up. He made them much more receptive. And then he actually built on it, and he sort of shared some stories from the field, which made them feel like heroes, because some of the initiatives that they had ultimately been responsible for were going quite well. And he showed them quotes and pictures of people who were testifying to this. And so it created this emotional crescendo and peak in the meeting. And then he sort of ended it off with, you know, with a sort of vision of where things could go. And so they sealed off this experience, you know, I think in the most positive possible way. I thought it was a great example of someone just he actually was doing this just because he's naturally talented, not because he studied the peak end rule, but he was doing exactly what one should do. And so it was a good example. It was a prototype of, you know, how to think about that rule and how to apply it to the design of client interactions.
So on the LinkedIn profile of Douglas Cole, does it mention Hello Kitty?
No, it doesn't. For precisely the possibility that I can answer that question.
See what I did there?
Yeah.
So just had two other quick things, big concepts I wanted to ask you about. And one is, you write that the contrast effect is a key part of a sales professional skill set. It should be seen as an important ally in the quest to replace confusion with clarity. Explain what the contrast effect is. Fairly powerful.
Yeah, so important. The concept is that we do not see things in absolute terms. Our brains process things in relative terms. It's really, really hard for us to see anything clearly without reference to some point of comparison. If I tell you, Douglas, you know, you should really send your kid to this school. It's a great school. You know, that's not enough information for you to get a sense of whether that would be a good decision. You need to know, well, compared to what? Compared mm-hmm. to what other school I might send my kid. And so it plays out in so many different areas of our lives and in so many areas of our working lives. And
it reminds me of the idea of wanting to get like three estimates for something you can have done to your house.
Right. And it also relates to this theme, which again I go back to in the book time and time again, which is just information overload. You know, everyone is dealing with information overload. So, and you need to be able to show information in such a way that you create an interesting contrast. You need to be able to show the difference between A and B, such that it actually registers and someone sees it as worth paying attention to. And so that applies to whether or not you're talking about the end of a sale and you're showing, let's say, different investment options. And it applies at the very beginning of the sale when you are talking about, you know, why your product or service or what about it is worth paying attention to. This ability to contrast, I think, is one of the most important foundational skills for sales professionals who have mastered the craft.
Right. And not giving too many options. And of course, this is where you talk about pricing and I think this may be the section, yeah, where you had the great story from Dan Ariely's book, Predictably Irrational, where they tested out the Economist subscriptions. I've read about that before. Mm-hmm. It's just, mm-hmm. It works. So yep. The last thing I wanted to ask about specifically from the book was, explain what is meant by outcome-focused labels work better than processed focused labels. And this is big implications for the marketing and communications folks. Outcome-based labels versus process-focused labels.
Yeah. Well, that's a concept that comes from the area of political polling groups. You know, people like George Lakoff, for example,
Frank Luntz, in the United States.
Words That Work. Yeah, those two in particular have done a lot of work in this field. And what they've discovered time and time again is that there can be a marked difference in the way that a focus group responds to a political policy idea, depending on how it's framed. So, for example, if you ask a bunch of right-leaning voters, you know, how they feel about welfare, then they'll have a very negative response to that term. But if you ask them how they feel about helping the poor, there's a very positive response mm-hmm. to that. And what I'm suggesting is that there's an analogy to this within a business context, where many times we'll talk about something in a generic or a conceptual fashion. We'll say something like, you know, digital transformation or operational efficiency. You know, we won't talk about the outcome. Which might be something like increase or shorten the deal cycle, for example, mm-hmm. Or lower cost, whatever the case. Like, the actual outcome we're trying to drive is the way we should be framing it, rather than, you know, as a noun or as an abstraction. So,
like finding more customers or closing deals faster, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Exactly. That's what I'm talking about with the, you know, naming and norming section.
Right. You talk about used car versus pre-owned vehicle, death tax versus estate tax,
yep.
gambling
yep.
versus gaming. It's just brilliant. Brilliant. So Douglas Cole, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
Well, I think there's one quote that I remember from Stephen Covey, you know, the guy who wrote The Seven Habits, mm-hmm. That I think is highly influential, or has been highly influential to me, and it's definitely one of the great influences of this book, and therefore I would say a takeaway. And he said at one point, he said that if you're looking to make incremental change, focus on the behavior. If you're looking to make a quantum change, focus on the paradigm, the mindset. And I think that that's the essence of what I'm trying to get across in this book, is that I think the most significant changes that we can affect in our own lives and others is when we change the mindset or the paradigm of someone. And that's what I'm trying to do in this book.
Yes. Yes. Well, is there one thing a listener could do today just to get them committed, to put in action one of the ideas from your book, perhaps one that we've talked about?
Well, particularly in a sales context, I think, you know, pause is the simplest way to put it. In sales is naturally a very reactive game. You know, a client requests something, you want to respond in lightning speed, and you tend not to pause and ask, well, what if this, then what, and how might that change my immediate response here? You know, salespeople will sometimes be asked for
a proposal.
A proposal, right? and
or literature.
They may not pause and consider these external organizational and interpersonal dimensions, which, if they were understood, would influence their response.
Yeah. It brings to mind something a boss said to me years and years ago. We're dealing with clients, and he said, always make a distinction, or try to make a distinction, between what a client wants and what they need.
Yes.
Because it's really fun. It makes you feel good to give exactly what they want. But if you're not asking why, I just don't know that you're going to get much further with them. Kind of like that example of the colleague you had who figured out what was actually important inside that organization. So yeah. They might have been asking for something else, but she started to figure out what they actually need.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, looking back, what books have most inspired your working career? I know we've mentioned a few already.
Working career, I would say probably the biggest inspiration has been probably two books. One would be The Effective Executive by Peter Drucker. Mm-hmm. The second would be Deep Work by Cal Newport.
Oh.
I think that the concept of deep work, I think it's an increasingly important concept, actually. You know, I think those who have a competitive advantage in the modern knowledge economy are those who can manage distractions the best. Oh. And I think deep work is essentially about that. And so that's been a huge influence on me.
Yes. Well, and I should also mention that at the end of your book, you have the sales MBA reading list, mm-hmm. which, of course, when I first got the book and looked at the table of contents, that was the first place I went. And it's got 33 books, not that I was counting, but it's great, great list of books. And it kind of gave me a sense of, wow, if those are the books that this author recommends, this is going to be good. And it was. So, well, are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or have heard of that you're looking forward to reading?
Yeah, well, you know, because I read so little fiction that when I do choose to read fiction, it's usually because there have been multiple filters that have been passed through in order for the recommendation to land. And a number of my friends have been telling me about Amor Towles, Gentleman in Moscow, and his latest book. And so I think it's good to go back to fiction because it's just a different way to exercise the brain. And I think particularly if you're interested in just good English prose, fiction is, you know, definitely generally more elevated than the nonfiction. And so that's something I'm looking forward to as a break from the usual.
Yes. A Gentleman in Moscow, Amor Towles. You know what? Another author has mentioned that one. So I may have to read that. And folks, don't be like me. Don't just read these nonfiction books. I actually read other stuff. It's like Willy Wonka in that book, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. The boy's on the tour and he finds out that they don't just eat chocolate and candy in the factory. They eat actually a balanced diet. So There you go. Well, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including all the books you've mentioned and your LinkedIn profile and your Twitter account. And now to the listener, please do me a big favor. Reach out to Douglas, not this Douglas, Douglas the guest, and congratulate him on this excellent book. Thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. Send him a message on LinkedIn or Twitter or any way that you can, because guests who've been on the show every week talk about how much they enjoy hearing from Marketing Book Podcast listeners, and not just because Marketing Book Podcast listeners are ridiculously good looking. And if you are listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Spotify or Apple Podcast, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. The book is The Sales MBA, How to Influence Corporate Buyers. The author is Douglas Cole. Douglas, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you very much, sir.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. Special thanks to this episode's sponsor, Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. For a free copy of the book, All-Inclusive TV, How Booming Brands Are Reimagining TV Advertising, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book. And tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast. And if you're one of the legions of listeners who have left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast stuff. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the late, great Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."